1987.
When you were pregnant with me, were you scared I'd have brown hair like you?
Emma stood before the full-length mirror in the front hall closet. She'd removed the rubber bands that had secured her two braids, and now she was running her fingers through her hair, untethering the sections. She took her time doing this, admiring her reflection.
Scared? Laura laughed. Why would I be scared you'd have brown hair?
Because blonde is better?
As she spoke, Emma's breath fogged the glass, obscuring her image.
I don't know where you got an idea like that, Laura said.
It's true.
Emma wiped the condensation away so she could see her face.
Everybody knows it.
Bath time, Laura said.
Maybe she's born with it,
Emma sang as she bent over so that her hair fell forward, covering her face.
Maybe it's Maybelline.
She flipped her head back up, teasing her hair into a poof.
Bath time, Laura repeated.
Emma held up a peremptory finger in her mother's direction.
Good night, darling,
she said, and leaned in to kiss her reflection. When Laura was a student at Winthrop, things were a certain way, and when a student's conduct deviated from this standard, she was told, "That's not the Winthrop way." Significant cultural changes had taken place in the intervening decades, but from what Laura observed on the tour for prospective parents, the Winthrop way had persevered. The day still began with prayers, in which students sang hymns and recited Bible verses. The girls were no longer required to wear blazers and berets upon exiting the building, but wore the traditional lime green tunics and seemed to carry themselves with the same deferential air. The hunched spine that afflicts so many women as they age had not touched Miss Gardner, who stood more erect than ever as she emerged from her office to greet the parents on the tour. Though Miss Gardner's stiff decorum now registered as more quaint than imperial, Laura still found herself intimidated by her former headmistress, who recognized her instantly.
"So wonderful to see you," Miss Gardner said, giving Laura's hand an extra long shake.
In the middle of the tour, one of the couples began quietly bickering. They also had a child at Park Avenue Protestant, though she was in a different class from Emma. Things gradually escalated, and as they filed into the auditorium, Laura heard the husband say, "How dare you talk about my kid like that?" Everyone heard the wife respond, "First of all, she's our kid. Secondly, what's wrong with being average?" Realizing all eyes were on her, the wife burst into tears and dashed into the hall. The husband dutifully lumbered after her. There was an awkward silence before Mrs. Olson, director of admissions, smiled and continued the tour without them. A few days later, Laura ran into the wife on the steps of Park Avenue Protestant. They'd both arrived early for pickup, and after exchanging hellos, the poor woman felt obligated to address what had transpired on the tour. Their daughter had scored in the 39th percentile on the preschool admissions test, and they had been told Winthrop was a long shot and not to even bother.
"But you know fathers," the wife said, rolling her eyes. "If it's their kid, she's got to be a genius."
Laura nodded sympathetically, and, wanting to make the woman feel better, told her that her own daughter had scored in the 37th percentile, though this was a wild guess. She hadn't bothered to find out Emma's results. Hearing this number, a look of irritation flashed across the wife's face, followed by a hostile smirk.
"And of course you have nothing to worry about," she said. "You're an alumni. Your daughter's a shoo-in."
School let out, for which Laura was grateful as she felt herself flushing. She'd tried to be nice to this woman, and she'd responded by shaming her for her background, making it sound like anything Emma achieved or would achieve, and by extension anything Laura had achieved or would achieve, was only the product of their privileged family, that on their own they would amount to nothing.
Alumna, Laura thought as she watched the woman greet her daughter. She had taken 3 years of Latin.
Janet, who'd attended Winthrop with Laura and whose two boys were enrolled at St. Christopher's, thought Laura was making a mistake in deciding to send Emma to the day school, the progressive alternative to Winthrop. She didn't come right out and say it, but conveyed her opinion in her typical Janet way, which was to start to say something she knew Laura didn't want to hear, and then stop short of saying all of it, eliciting Laura's curiosity and forcing her to tease the rest out.
"I'm not sure about the day school," Janet was saying. "The atmosphere is a little, I don't know."
"A little what?" Laura asked.
"A little hippy-dippy." "As for the quality of the education," Janet continued, "I can't speak to that, but I have heard things about their approach that would give me pause."
"Such as?"
"That it's a bit loosey-goosey."
"Can you give me an example of what you mean by that?"
"Apparently, they let students learn to read at their own pace. In the meantime, there's an entire unit devoted to teaching students how to make their own shoes," Janet said. "It's a bit artsy-fartsy, if you catch my drift."
"I see your point," Laura said, "but these are all the reasons why I think it would be a good fit for Emma. She's a spirited little girl. Let's face it, Winthrop's a little hoity-toity."
"If you really want my honest opinion, Laura dear, and I say this as one of your oldest friends, it's you I don't see fitting in at the day school."
"Well, I won't be the one going," Laura pointed out.
"Yes, but you'd be surprised how much parents are expected to be involved these days."
According to Janet, there was a middle school puberty unit at the day school, where parents were expected to come into the classroom, sit in a circle, and say the names they called their private parts. Laura laughed. "They would never do that. It's the most ridiculous idea I've ever heard."
"It's absolutely true. It's supposed to make kids feel more comfortable about their bodies."
"More comfortable?" Laura laughed even harder. She didn't believe it, but this didn't stop her from conjuring the scenario, and the dizzying, dry-mouthed, anticipatory panic of her rapidly advancing turn. Daisy canceled an hour before Laura had to be at the library to receive a late shipment of flowers for a wedding taking place the next day. Although Laura didn't normally trust her mother to babysit Emma, she had no other option. The delivery kept getting delayed. Finally, at 6 o'clock, Laura headed to 136 to pick up Emma. The house was quiet. "Hello?" she called, letting herself in. "Hello?" she tried again. She walked through the dining room and into the living room, which was also dark and empty. "Hello? Anyone home?" She thought she smelled something cooking and poked her head into the kitchen. A pot boiled on the stove, and Sandra sat at the kitchen table flipping through a tabloid.
"Oh, hi," Laura smiled warmly. "Wasn't sure if anyone was home. Have you seen Emma and my mother?"
"I just get here," Sandra said, licking an index finger to turn the page.
"I see. Thank you, Sandra."
"Thank your father. He pay me."
Laura nodded and forced another smile. She wished Sandra wouldn't say that. She could never be sure if it was a cultural thing or if there was some hostility.
"Hello?" Laura called, walking upstairs. "Emma? Bibbs?"
The second floor hall was dark, but she noticed light from beneath the door to her parents' bedroom. She knocked lightly. When there was no response, she knocked louder, and then she opened the door.
"Shh!"
Bibbs hissed from across the room.
There they were in bed, Emma sprawled like a frog across her grandmother, body rising and falling to the rhythm of Bibbs' breaths.
A half-eaten carton of melting rainbow sherbet rested on the bedside table, beside two cans of ginger ale and a plate with the remains of toast with smoked salmon. Bibbs ran her fingers through Emma's unbraided hair, which cascaded across her shoulders.
"How long has she been out?" Laura asked.
Bibbs shot her a fierce look.
"You'll wake her," she whispered sternly.
"Yes, that's my intention," Laura said. "Naps aren't good. It means she'll never fall asleep at her bedtime."
She put her hand on Emma's back and gently shook. Emma? Time to go home.
Don't want to, Emma said drowsily.
Let her stay, Bibbs said, wrapping her arms around her defensively.
You too. Laura stood back and folded her arms and chuckled. I wish I had my camera right now.
Her amusement was short-lived, however. It was getting late, and she was tired. After a few futile minutes of trying to rally Emma, she'd had enough. Fine, she said. It's not a weeknight. You two want to have a sleepover? Go ahead.
Laura paused by the door and blew Emma a kiss.
Call me if you need anything.
When Emma didn't object to her exiting the room, she continued downstairs, considering the possibility of carrying through with the threat. It felt irresponsible to just walk out the door. But why? Sandra was here. Her father would be getting home soon. What was the danger? It wasn't often that Laura had a night to herself. She could see a movie, sit at the bar of a restaurant with a book, order mussels and a glass of red wine. She could go back to the apartment, get takeout, and watch PBS. She had many options, and they were all things she enjoyed and wished she were able to do more often, so it didn't make sense to her that now that the opportunity had presented itself, she didn't want to do any of them.
Laura was hurt when, in March of that year, a letter arrived from the day school, rejecting Emma from their incoming kindergarten class. Wasn't a progressive school supposed to be non-exclusionary? Weren't they supposed to take everyone? Laura called her mother, who shared her outrage.
They're idiots, Bibbs said.
Absolute idiots. Emma, on the other hand, couldn't have been more excited to learn she'd be attending Winthrop.
I get a uniform, I get a uniform, I get a uniform, she sang.
Laura's 8-week paid summer vacation, a component of her part-time work schedule, meant that the library could no longer offer weddings during the months of July and August. Summer weddings had been a significant source of revenue, and Laura felt guilty about this. But she felt even guiltier, imagining Emma's spending the summer in sweltering, stuffy Manhattan. And so, at the end of every June, they packed up the car and headed up I-95.
Ushant was a finger of land that jutted out into Buzzards Bay, Massachusetts. Laura's paternal great-grandparents had bought the land at the turn of the century, building a summer cottage at the tip of the peninsula. In the ensuing decades, more houses had been constructed to accommodate their descendants. None of the houses were winterized, and for 9 months they sat empty. In June, station wagons began to arrive, and by July the place was teeming with relatives, Laura's first and second cousins, their parents and spouses and children. Ushant was too rustic for Bibbs' taste, and Nicholas was allergic, so the house that Douglas had inherited was occupied solely by Laura and Emma.
You know, we're very lucky to have Ushant, Laura told Emma as they pulled up to the entrance. Ushant Point, private property, no trespassing, bicyclists and walkers, please turn around, read the sign. Laura rolled down the window and reached out to punch the security code into the keypad.
Most people don't have something like this, she reiterated as they waited for the metal gate to retract. They don't get to spend the whole summer at a nice house by the ocean with their cousins. They have to stay in the city and work.
Emma sucked the last drops of liquid in her juice box with such force that the walls of the container caved in.
Ah, she hissed.
The road was paved but narrow and potholed, for two cars driving the opposite direction to pass each other, one had to veer into the grassy embankment while the other inched by. After the gate, it snaked through a wooded enclave before the houses began. Proximity to the water compromised arboreal fertility. As the road crept along, hardy hemlocks and matronly firs gave way to adolescent cedars, clematis, and bayberry bushes. It was too early for crickets, but the country quiet was embroidered with the quivering thrum of cicadas, punctuated by the occasional peeper, newly born and safely sequestered within lush thickets of tall grass, their starchy stalks adorned with feathered plumes, which swayed in deferential submission to the encroaching ocean and quicksilver sky.
Though the first whiff of salty sea air still evoked feelings of joy for Laura, upon stepping into the house, a sense of dread set in, as she braced herself for the physical discomforts of the weeks to come. To Laura's disgust, but also fascination, there was a distinctly soggy spot on the old straw rug in the front hall, the result of a glass of lemonade being spilled in the early 1960s. She had been there and witnessed the accident. The scientific explanation was that, once wet, nothing ever completely dried in a shunt. Bedding, rugs, towels, dogs, your hair, no matter how long you spent blow-drying it, there was nothing the ocean air couldn't penetrate. Even the wood the houses were made of was soft and mossy to the touch, and if you pressed your fingernail into one of the clabbered panels, it would leave an indentation. As Laura brought their bags in, she noticed the house was disconcertingly still. Then she remembered she hadn't flicked the switch in the basement that turned on the electricity. As soon as she did, the floors hummed to life, with the comfortingly familiar vibrations of the ancient avocado green refrigerator, which, for reasons Laura always meant to ask the caretaker to investigate, in addition to a steady rumbling, occasionally squawked like a bird. After unloading the groceries, Laura rinsed the fruit and placed it in a bowl in the middle of the kitchen table. A pair of fruit flies immediately descended upon it. She fished through the pantry in search of the protective mesh dome, but by the time she located it, they'd seemingly procreated into a village. A fly swatter hung from a rusty nail by the light switch, but Laura couldn't be bothered. Like mold-speckled pillowcases and clammy sheets, fruit flies were a fact of life in Ashant. There was no point in trying to fight them. Emma excavated her bike from the garage and took off to go find her cousins. After dust-busting the mouse turds out of their dresser drawers, Laura unpacked their clothes and stored their suitcases in the hall closet. She had returned to the kitchen to get dinner started when Emma flew in and breathlessly announced she would be eating at Holly's house that night. Before Laura had a chance to respond, she'd scampered off, the screen door bouncing behind her. Laura picked up the phone to call Holly's mother, who confirmed the invitation.
"We're having tomato salad, truffle risotto, and swordfish," Ginny said apologetically. "Is that okay? Will Emma eat that? Tell me the truth, because I'm more than happy to make mac and cheese."
"Emma will eat anything," Laura told her. "Thank you for having her. We'll have Holly tomorrow." Laura made a fried egg and sat down with a New Yorker article titled "The End of Nature." It was about the greenhouse effect, and the news was grim. She tried to commit certain facts to memory to use in future debates, though it seemed pointless. The skeptics weren't so much unconvinced as ideologically opposed to the notion that anything that made life convenient for them could be bad for the planet. They subscribed to a view of things that didn't tolerate such discord. They were almost always men. Laura knew and was related to many of them. The house had a chill, and after dinner she collected some logs and laid a fire, but hesitated to light it when she heard some activity in the chimney. She made a note to call the caretaker in the morning, and in case she forgot the reason, wrote, "Raccoon back." It was almost 9, and Emma still hadn't returned. Laura had slept poorly the night before and was exhausted from the drive. She wanted to go to bed. Finally, the phone rang, and it was Emma, calling to say the grown-ups wanted Laura to come over and play a game with them.
"A game?" Laura yawned. "What kind of game?"
"Dial tone." Laura put on a sweater, slipped on her flip-flops, and shuffled out into the night. Ginny shared a house with her sister Dinah, and between the two of them they had 3 dogs, 4 cars, and 7 kids, Holly being the youngest and the only girl. Built in the 70s, theirs was one of the newer, bigger, more controversial houses on Ashant. It had a television, a room in the basement with electronic exercise machines, and there were rumors they were planning to install a swimming pool. A swimming pool on Ashant? Surrounded by ocean? No one could imagine it. Laura hoped it wasn't true, but given their husbands, she wouldn't be surprised. Ginny and Dinah had married Timmy and Rick, who'd been best friends growing up in Boston. Timmy and Rick liked sports, grilling meat, and arguing about what was the best kind of car. Laura had once heard something strange about Rick, which was that he got regular manicures for some medical reason having to do with his cuticles. Other than that, both brothers-in-law were straight out of a commercial. Unabashedly American they were.
"Ah, great, she's here," someone said as Laura let herself in. "We can play."
In addition to Dinah, Ginny, and Tweedledum and Tweedledumdum, as Bibbs referred to Timmy and Rick, were two additional couples at the table. After introducing Laura and the house guests, Dinah explained the game, which was called Fantasy. Everyone was to think of a secret fantasy, write it down on a slip of paper, fold it up, and put it in a bowl. The bowl would be passed around as people took turns drawing a slip, reading what it said, and guessing whose fantasy it was.
"Remember to disguise your handwriting," Ginny said, distributing paper and pens.
After a few turns, Laura quickly regretted what she'd written, which did not fit with the tone of the game. Most of the wishes concerned benign vices. Beer turns out to prevent cancer. And playful criticism of one's spouse. "My husband learns how to do laundry." Laura wasn't sure why "my wife is insatiable" was so funny, but she pretended to find it as amusing as the others. Laughter came easily to this group, and that their sense of humor wasn't particularly sophisticated did little to mitigate Laura's feeling of inferiority in the personality department. Stripped of the routine responsibilities of day-to-day life, a person's value in Ashant was his or her company, and Laura was aware hers wasn't the most fun. People liked her, of course, but no one went out of their way to spend time with her. She wouldn't have even been invited to this game night if not for Emma. Laura's slip of paper was drawn by a house guest husband. In addition to being much too earnest, the fantasy was politically awkward. She could tell by the look of this man, pink shorts, yellow polo, sailboat-embroidered belt, that he was a card-carrying Republican, and what she'd written concerned global warming, the government's restriction of CO2 emissions, and harsher legal repercussions for companies who flouted the law, including jail sentences for high-level executives. It was a long-winded wish, and took a while for the man to read. When he was done, there was a silence, broken only by Rick saying, "That one was mine," to which everyone boisterously laughed. "I've never played this game before," Laura apologized when they'd settled down. "I'll do better next time."
"Can Emma stay for a sleepover?" Holly pleaded when Laura said it was time to go.
"Fine with me," Ginny said. As Laura let herself out the front door, a fresh shock of laughter shook the house and broke like a wave, spilling out onto the porch, down the steps and onto the grass, the foamy lick of its wake seeming to chase Laura's feet as she headed up toward the road, back to her house, into the damp sheets of her bed, where the only sound was the occasional scuttling of squirrels within the walls. While the other mothers were always complaining about how busy they were, the never-ending laundering of towels, the hosing down of sandy feet, the de-ticking of dogs, Laura found it a challenge to fill up her days on Ashant, especially now that Emma was 5 and no longer required constant supervision. For kids, Ashant meant freedom. They roamed about in packs, barefoot, bug-bitten, and sunburned, scattering like rabbits upon spotting an approaching adult. As evening arrived, there was a gradual disbanding as the cousins returned to their respective houses for dinner. An older cousin would be charged with escorting Emma home. This reaffirmed her status as Ashant's lone, only child, of a single parent to boot, and was an abrupt and sobering conclusion to the excitement of the day. Fortunately, the action would resume in the morning. Eager not to miss out, Emma took off each day after breakfast, returning only to dash upstairs to retrieve something from her bedroom, change into her bathing suit, or seek Laura's permission to join another family's picnic or boating expedition to the islands. On the occasions she reported home for lunch, Emma brought guests, sometimes as many as half a dozen second cousins, whom Laura, feeling guilty about all the lunches their parents had served Emma, was more than eager to accommodate. When she wasn't mass-producing tuna melts, Laura occupied herself with books and organization projects. Her mornings were industrious, but as the briny air had a way of eroding the houses, the sun-bleached hours of midday
had a way of chipping away at Laura's resolve to keep plugging away at whatever endeavor she'd undertaken that day, which suddenly seemed pointless. Laura was determined to keep Ashant's shoreline completely litter-free. Each tide deposited a fresh spattering of miscellaneous refuse, shards of glass, styrofoam cups, buoys, so this was an ongoing project. As the summer progressed, she expanded her sweeps to include the craggy tip of the point, where the rocks got bigger and bigger until they were more like boulders. It was difficult to navigate, and the one area where children were forbidden to go. No one went there, in fact, and adding to the spooky feeling, the outer tip of the point had once been used as a military base during the Second World War, a lookout spot in case enemies invaded. During this time, the government had temporarily confiscated the area where her great-grandparents had built their original house, which had been torn down to make room for a makeshift command center, beneath which they'd constructed a series of underground tunnels where the soldiers had lived. In Laura's memory of sneaking out here as a child, the iron door that led to these tunnels had always been locked. She was relieved to discover this remained the case. At the base of the entrance was a smooth patch of asphalt, and the radiating heat sent a pleasant shiver up Laura's legs. The sun felt good on her exposed skin, and she decided to lie down and get a little tan. She was completely secluded, so she took off her shorts and shirt. A few minutes later, she removed her bra. When would she get the chance again? She kept her underpants on. The boat didn't make a sound, and Laura wondered how long it had been there. Sitting up, one arm covering her breasts, she groped for her shirt. She knew the man inside the boat had been watching, because he abruptly turned around and cast his fishing rod on the other side, facing away from her. Laura left in such a hurry she forgot her bag of trash. When she went back for it the next day, the boat was there again, closer to shore than she'd remembered it being before. Before turning up toward the asphalt, Laura looked at the fisherman, and he looked back at her, and then turned to an angle where he couldn't see her. Today, Laura had worn a bikini beneath her clothes, and after stripping down to it, she sat on the asphalt, keeping tabs on the fisherman, making sure his back was to her as she removed her top. She lay down so she couldn't see him, but she could feel that he was now watching her. Again, she forgot the bag of trash. So began a new secret routine. The fisherman was handsome, in a weathered man-of-the-sea kind of way, but it wasn't so much he who excited Laura as his lust for her, and the unspoken and illicit nature of their arrangement. My fisherman, she came to think of him. There was a constant anxiety about time and the rapid passing of it on Ashant. The crickets are getting louder as they are getting closer to death, an aunt had once told Laura when she was a child, and there was rarely an evening on Ashant when she didn't think of it. The summer is almost over, people started saying soon after the 4th of July. As August rolled around, the dread of September took on an existential air, and each sunset had the sensation of being the last. While Laura looked forward to returning to the routine of their lives in New York, the feeling still got to her, and it was especially acute when she arrived at her secret spot at the end of the point and discovered her fisherman wasn't there. There had been a few days when he hadn't shown up, but this was her final afternoon of the summer. A few hours later, their car was loaded and ready to go. Disconsolate at the prospect of leaving, Emma climbed a tree and refused to come down. After a 15-minute standoff, she surrendered, under the condition that they stopped for a final dip at the swimming dock. The water was cold, and she lasted less than a minute. Weeping and shivering, Emma climbed back up the steps. Laura toweled her off, and they were about to leave when Maggie, one of her oldest and frailest great-aunts, arrived for a swim, and Laura thought they should linger to make sure she didn't drown.
"You have a lot of freckles," Emma said between sniffles, pointing to Maggie's shins.
"Those are liver spots, dear," Maggie told her, meticulously tucking every last rogue wisp of silver hair beneath the rubbery base of her mustard-yellow bathing cap. She stood up, unfastened the belt of her towel coat, and shed it, with the comfort one did a winter jacket. Skinny dipping had once been the norm at Ashant,
and for older generations it remained the preference. Maggie's knuckles flashed white as she gripped the railing that ran along the steps leading to the water. It was a long, slow, cautious descent, but eventually she reached the last step, arched her back, tossed up her arms, and dove in with a splash. Once she was in the water, there was no trace of the prudence with which Maggie negotiated her movements on land. Her body seemed transformed into a younger, stronger, more confident one. Even her breasts appeared miraculously restored to their former shape and buoyancy. As she flipped over, they broke the surface of the water like pale blue moons, growing smaller and smaller as she backstroked toward the horizon. Eventually, Maggie reversed direction. As they waited, a boat appeared in the distance. Laura assumed it was Rick, who was known for driving his boat much too fast and close to the swimming dock. His proximity to Maggie made Laura nervous, and she waved her hands in the air, trying to signal for him to slow down. The boat did slow down, but Laura's relief was fleeting as she realized it was not Rick.
"Who is that?"
Emma asked as the boat approached the dock. "We don't know him," Laura said.
"Trespasser,"
Emma muttered with a growl. "The ocean doesn't belong to us," Laura said quietly. Close to the steps, Laura's fisherman put the boat in neutral. It bobbed menacingly as he stared at Laura, who wanted to turn away but was afraid to do so. She'd never seen him this close for this long, and there was something in his face she'd never observed before, an uncouth, wanton look in his eyes.
"What's he doing here?"
Emma whispered. Laura squeezed her hand but didn't speak. Her fear was laced with shame and remorse. Laura had been reckless. Thinking of what she had done, she felt she didn't know herself.
"Sir," Maggie's voice carried sharply over the water, "I would like to get out, and I'm not wearing a suit. If you could please give me some privacy?"
And with that, he took off, the wake of his boat unzipping the water like the back of a dress. As Laura had anticipated, Emma struggled with the Winthrop way. It was only November, and the fourth time she had done something that prompted a telephone call home about behavior that was inappropriate, a word with which she was now very familiar. Today's incident was regarding a picture Emma had drawn featuring inappropriate content that had left her kindergarten teacher a little concerned. "No need to mince your words," Laura told Miss Cole. "Let me know what it was, and I'll talk to her." She drew a man who was in his birthday suit. "Oh, dear," Laura sighed. "I can explain. Last weekend we were about to cross the street when all of a sudden a man in a proverbial trench coat appeared out of nowhere and did his thing." Miss Cole did not say anything. "Life on 96th Street," Laura mustered a chuckle. "Anyway, thanks for letting me know. I appreciate the call. Here she comes now. I'll have to have a chat with her. Goodbye, Miss Cole. See you tomorrow." Laura hung up the phone and looked at Emma, who stood in the doorway clutching a stack of freshly dog-eared catalogs. That Laura never processed Emma's orders didn't stop the catalogs from piling up. At 5, Emma remained in the upper percentiles for height and weight. Though her body had lengthened, she still had the distended paunch of a toddler, the bulk of which was further exaggerated by the pleated skirt of her Winthrop tunic billowing out like a tent. This belly was her center of gravity, and she carried it with a regal immodesty, letting it announce her as she entered spaces. "Guess who that was?"
"Miss Cole?" Emma said in a baby voice.
Laura nodded. "Why do you think she was calling?"
"How am I supposed to know?"
Emma's shoulders rose in a phony way. "The word is supposed, and I think you do know."
"Because my weekend update was inappropriate?"
Emma timidly placed the catalogs on Laura's desk.
"Bingo." "Bingo?"
"Yes, you're correct. That's why Miss Cole was calling." Laura searched Emma's face for signs of remorse.
They're called private parts for a reason, Emma said, clearly repeating what Miss Cole had said to her.
If you knew it was inappropriate, why did you draw it?
Emma shrugged again.
You're not a little kid anymore. I know that you understand these things. The question is, what inspires you to pretend not to know any better? Do you think it's funny? Do you think it's cute?
Emma chewed the inside of her lip and looked at the floor.
Do you know how embarrassing it is for me as your mother to get these phone calls?
Emma nodded. The expression on her face was sober, if not wholly contrite.
You don't draw pictures of penises in school, Laura said.
You don't draw pictures of penises in school, Emma repeated.
Or what we have, Laura added, as Emma turned to go back to her room.
Vaginas, Emma shouted as she skipped down the hall.
On the third Sunday of every month, Laura helped make dinner for the residents of a local women's shelter. Emma typically stayed home, but one evening the babysitter canceled and Laura took her along. It was here, in the kitchen, that Emma met Sylvia. She had never met anyone named Sylvia before. It was the most beautiful name she'd ever heard. And with her pretty red hair and pink lipstick, Sylvia was the most beautiful homeless person Emma had ever seen. Sylvia was other things Emma had never encountered before, including the only adult who hadn't been amused or flustered by the question, "Do you think God is real?" Sylvia didn't think God was real. She knew he was. She had seen him, and he had spoken to her. Emma was equally awed by Sylvia's thoughts on Jesus.
He is the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through him.
As they were saying goodbye, Sylvia told Emma that she used to wear glasses, but after praying for God to fix her vision, one day she'd woken up to discover God had fixed her vision. Now that she no longer needed glasses, she could see everything, including things other people couldn't. Emma wanted to know what these things that Sylvia could see and normal people couldn't were, and when she asked, Sylvia said she could see that Emma wasn't like other children, that she was special. On their way home, Emma asked if Sylvia could be her babysitter the next time Laura had to go out.
But what about Daisy? Laura responded. You love Daisy.
Emma shook her head.
She doesn't pay me any attention. She's always talking on the phone.
I'll think about it, Laura said.
Beautiful child, Sylvia gasped,
as Emma entered the living room in the new floor-grazing dirndl her grandparents had brought back from the previous summer's trip to Europe. As Emma walked across the room toward the sofa, where Sylvia sat waiting for her, she took small, delicate steps, making sure her toes didn't poke out from beneath her skirt, so as to create the impression that she wasn't walking, but floating, like the sugar plum fairies in the opening scene of the second half of The Nutcracker. Sylvia was supposed to be the babysitter, but Laura stayed in the apartment the whole time. Emma escorted Sylvia to her bedroom and shut the door. She handed Sylvia a brush and requested that she do her hair to look like Marta's in The Sound of Music, two braids twisted and pinned above her ears. After this, Sylvia taught Emma the proper way to pray, knees on the floor, head bowed, hands clasped, lips moving but no sound coming out. Emma prayed for, among other things, sisters and brothers, glasses, braces, a dog, a pet rabbit, a Polly Pocket, for the ozone layer to grow back, to be in the next Olympics, for Nickelodeon to come take over her school, for it to be the olden days, for Sylvia to be her governess, and for God not to punish her mom even though she didn't believe in him. This last wish Emma verbalized to Sylvia, who agreed it was a concern. When Laura poked her head in the door to check on them, Sylvia said,
"If serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourself, but remember in whose land you are living."
Laura smiled and said that it was probably getting time for Sylvia to go home.
As Sylvia and Emma stood in the hall waiting for the elevator, Emma had a sinking, panicky feeling. She had an idea. She ran back inside and returned with a slim glass vial that had once held Indian beads. Removing its cork stopper, she handed the vial to Sylvia and asked her to breathe inside it. She did. Emma corked the bottle, and the elevator door opened and Sylvia stepped in. Holding Sylvia's breath to her chest, Emma stood and watched the panel above the elevator illuminate the number of the floor she was on. 17, 16, 15, 14, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, until it stopped at L.
"Goodbye, Sylvia," Emma said, and kissed the bottle.
Getting out the door each morning was a production, and Emma's first report card noted that she had been delivered late to school on 13 separate occasions. There was no mention of Laura's tardiness at afternoon pickup. She had been a bit relaxed about these. But beneath the attendance record, Miss Cole had added a personal note. "Let's see if we can all do better in the winter term." Laura made a concerted effort to be more punctual, and she made it through January without an issue. Such was shaping up to be the case with February, when tragic circumstances intervened. She didn't know of anyone this had happened to, although most people she knew didn't ride the subway. When acquaintances learned that Laura, petite, demure Laura, braved the dangerous and chaotic New York City underground twice a day by herself, they were flabbergasted. But it was a point of pride for her, a method of transportation that was cheaper, generally quicker, and certainly more environmentally friendly than taking a cab. And there was invariably a character or two in your car. The people who didn't use it were missing out on a quintessential New York experience, never venturing out of their safe little bubble. She was on her way to pick up Emma as her train approached the 96th Street station. Laura stood up to wait by the door, gripping the overhead bar to steady herself. After pulling abreast of the platform, the train stopped with a violent jerk, but the doors did not open. 5 minutes passed, and the doors remained closed, and there were no announcements explaining why. Subway officials were out on the track with flashlights looking beneath the train. A few of the passengers in Laura's car tried to communicate with them via hand gestures and exasperated expressions, but were ignored. Finally, the conductor's voice came on over the radio and said that due to a police investigation, the train was no longer in service and everyone needed to disembark. Police had congregated on the platform. Farther down the platform, passengers who'd emerged from another car peered over the ledge at something on the track. From the expressions on their faces, Laura knew what it was. Laura felt quivery, like her knees might buckle. The poor conductor, she considered. How traumatic for him. As for the person, she couldn't bear to think of it. Had they been pushed? Jumped? Perhaps they'd been standing too close to the yellow line when a rat had come along and scurried between their feet, and being skittish, they'd accidentally leapt forward. That had long been a fear of hers. A childish part of Laura wanted to join the gawkers at the end of the platform, but shame prevented her from indulging such morbid curiosity. Slipping her hands into the pockets of her coat, she proceeded in the other direction, away from the spectacle, toward the exit. As she headed up the steps to the street, she had to step aside for a team of paramedics. That they didn't appear in a particular rush extinguished any doubt she'd had regarding what had happened. Laura arrived at Winthrop to find Emma standing on the front steps with Miss Cole. As she approached, Miss Cole patted the top of Emma's head and said, "Do you want to tell Mom how it makes you feel when she's late?"
"Like, my time is... like, your time is more important than me," Emma said.
The suspiciously adult language was not lost on Laura, who resented that Miss Cole would plant such an idea in Emma's head.
"Of course that's not true," Laura said. "I'm late because my subway was delayed."
"You always say that," Emma huffed.
"Well, today was especially bad. There was some sort of police investigation and they wouldn't let us off the train." Shifting her gaze up to Miss Cole, Laura mouthed the word
casualty.
Grinning her customary frigid grin, Miss Cole responded, "These things happen." Laura was confused. "These things happen" was something you said to pardon someone who'd committed a minor transgression, not to the shaken bystander of a tragic accident. In case Miss Cole had failed to register it, Laura leaned over and whispered in her ear, "My subway ran someone over."
"Mom," Emma tugged Laura's coat, "can we go?"
As they waited to cross Lexington at 96th Street, Laura noticed a crowd of people loitering outside the entrance to the subway. Several police cars and an ambulance idled by the curb. Their timing couldn't have been worse. The light turned, and just as they reached the other side, the team of paramedics Laura had seen going down the subway steps came back up. In her 6 years of living in New York City, Emma had seen a number of people on stretchers being loaded into ambulances. She was curious why this one was zipped up in a black bag.
"How can the person breathe?" she wanted to know.
"He did," one of the corner boys answered. "Hit by a train," another added, smacking his fist into his palm.
"In real life, did that happen?" Emma asked as they stepped into the building. "A man got hit by a train and died in real life?"
"Of course not," Laura said. "I'm sure he's fine." When the elevator reached their floor, it always overshot its destination by a small margin, and as it reversed direction, there was a brief moment when the body recalibrated its momentum, creating a feeling of low-gravity weightlessness, similar to being in a car on the crest of a hill, or a roller coaster. Emma, who usually attempted to prolong the sensation by jumping up as it happened, did not do so today. By dinner time, she was herself again. As she squeezed the ketchup bottle, it made a wheezing, spluttery sound, and she giggled.
"Mom," she said, "listen."
She repeated the sound several times for Laura's benefit, laughing with each stertorous squeeze.
"What does that sound like?"
"Very amusing," Laura said.
"But what does it sound like?"
"Like passing gas."
"Passing gas,"
Emma squealed, seeming to find these words even funnier than the corresponding sound effect.
"It's called a fart, Mom."
Emma revisited the subject of mortality as Laura tucked her into bed that night.
"Does it happen to everyone?" she asked. "Every person in the whole wide world?"
Laura nodded. "Eventually."
"The good news is, we all get to be together again in heaven," Emma said as Laura snapped off the light.
"Some people believe that," Laura said in a neutral tone.
"Are there some people who never die?" Emma asked Dr. Brown at her next appointment. "Like kings and queens?"
Dr. Brown pursed his lips and shook his head. "Even kings and queens die," he told Emma, resting a hand on her bare knee. "Part of life is that one day, it's over. Everyone and everything that is ever alive, one day, dies. Trees, plants, flowers, birds, bugs, dogs, people, butterflies, we all die. It's what makes our time together so meaningful, knowing that each moment we're alive is so precious." Laura tried to make eye contact with him to communicate her gratitude for his sensible yet gentle response, but Dr. Brown's gaze remained fixed on Emma as she grappled with this information. His furrowed brow and periodic blinks conveyed something. Laura wasn't sure what, but it struck her as something important, something so fundamental there wasn't a word for it, something that she hadn't been offered as a child, and was hence unequipped to provide herself. As soon as Laura hung up the phone, a crisis of confidence set in. Was it crossing professional boundaries for a pediatrician to socialize with the parent of a patient? Yes, Laura decided, but she had initiated it, and he'd been too polite to decline, and now it was too late. Dr. Brown was coming for dinner next Wednesday, and there was no uninviting him. She tried to get used to the idea of it, visualizing the evening from Dr. Brown's perspective. It pleased her to imagine his surprise walking down their block, taking note of the grungy store on the corner, the row of abandoned tenements across the street, the wall with the graffiti, and then stepping into their building to be greeted by Frank with his cats and cigarettes. Their humble circumstances would impress and move him. They weren't at all like his other patients. She would need to make a visit to the liquor store, but what should she get? Most men she knew drank whiskey, but that didn't seem like Dr. Brown's kind of thing. A bottle of wine seemed appropriate, though she'd have to ask him to open it. But what if he was a recovering alcoholic? Laura took out the Moosewood Cookbook and the Enchanted Broccoli Forest. She was not a confident cook, but the book's slapdash aesthetic and casually chatty tone, sprinkle hither and thither, taste to see if it wants more salt, bring the whole pan to the table so your eating partners can see how attractive the dish looks, had inspired her to believe it wasn't too late to become one, that it was simply a matter of allowing her culinary intuition to take over. After giving it more thought, Laura decided it was safer to stick with her usual dinner party menu of chicken, wild rice, and peas, followed by a simple green leaf salad. Or perhaps the salad should come first. Laura had grown up eating salads after the main meal, but some people found this strange and confusing. Laura planned to give Emma an early bath, so she'd be all ready for bed when Dr. Brown rang the doorbell. She'd let Emma open the door, say hello to Dr. Brown, and then Laura would escort her to the TV room, where the VCR would be set up with The Sound of Music. Though Emma would likely fall asleep before the movie ended, Laura also prepared herself for the possibility of an interruption. Emma loved dressing up and making theatrical entrances. In Laura's experience, dinner guests always found this amusing. Would Dr. Brown? Yes, of course he would. Dr. Brown was very fond of Emma. The week passed, and Laura got more and more used to the idea of Dr. Brown coming for dinner and was even excited about it. The morning of the dinner date, she took the elevator down with Emma and read Frank's handwritten sign that had been scotch-taped to the wall the last few days. No water Wednesday, noon to 8 p.m. Only now did she put two and two together. It was too late to cancel. There was only one option. The dinner would have to happen at her parents' house. Dr. Brown arrived at 136 with a flower in his hand, a single long-stemmed red rose. Laura reached out to take it, and he started to give it to her, but just before it reached her fingers, he pulled it back and said, "Is she still up?" She felt like a fool thinking it was for her, but also relieved as receiving flowers from men had always embarrassed her.
"Douglas," her father said, offering him his hand.
"Bibbs," her mother said.
"Bibbs?" Dr. Brown repeated.
"Short for Barbara?"
"Vivian," she corrected.
"It's Vivs," Dr. Brown clarified as Laura led him upstairs to say hi to Emma, who was watching TV in the library.
"Bibbs," Laura's mother boomed from below. "Two B's, as in bosoms."
Emma was sitting mesmerized in front of The Sound of Music. "Dr. Brown is here," Laura said as she leaned down to put the VCR on pause.
"Hello, Emma," Dr. Brown stooped down to her. "This is for you."
He handed her the rose. Emma examined it while rolling its stem between her fingers.
"What do you say?" Laura prompted.
"Thank you kindly," Emma said in her theatrical voice.
Dr. Brown laughed.
"You're most welcome," he said.
"Thank you kindly," Laura repeated as they walked back downstairs. I'm not sure where she picked that up.
"So," Bibbs said when they were all seated for dinner, "you must love children."
Dr. Brown smiled and looked like he was about to reply when she continued. "When Laura was little, she used to say the most peculiar things. One morning, she said, 'Mummy, you're going to have to divorce Daddy, because when I grow up, I'm going to marry him.'"
"No, I didn't." Laura blushed. She did not remember this and found it hard to believe.
"Oh, you did," Bibbs said with a wild grin. "And another time, you were watching Nicholas have a bath, and you said,
I have one, too, and it's even better because it's hidden, and no one can cut it off.
Douglas interrupted by asking Dr. Brown where he had grown up, but it was too late. The dinner was ruined for Laura.
Ohio, Dr. Brown said, his face red with amusement.
At least he found her mother entertaining. Laura couldn't believe she'd thought this would be a better idea than canceling.
Cleveland, Bibb said excitedly. Did you know the Davenports?
No, he said, shaking his head and smiling.
The Davenports are from St. Louis, Douglas said.
You're wrong, wrong, wrong. They're from Cleveland.
And what did your father do? Douglas asked.
My father wasn't in the picture, Dr. Brown said. My mother was a teacher. We lived in a small town a few hours from Cleveland. That's fascinating, Bibb said, slapping the table in excitement. Don't you think so, Douglas?
Her husband nodded.
To grow up the child of a single mother in rural America? Bibb slapped the table again.
Do you have any brothers or sisters? Laura asked.
A twin sister, Dr. Brown answered. Tina.
The subject of Emma's infancy came up. After talking about how big she was, Dr. Brown asked if Laura, too, was a large baby at birth.
Oh, no, no, Bibb shook her head. She was a beautiful, delicate little thing.
Premature, Douglas added.
I was? Laura asked. She'd never heard this before, but it would explain why she was so much shorter than all the women in her family.
She was not premature, Bibbs countered. She was perfectly healthy, just small.
How small was I? Laura asked.
Small enough that they kept you in the hospital for a bit, Douglas said.
When she finally came home, Bibbs addressed Dr. Brown. She was so tiny, I thought she might break. I was too scared to hold her, but the baby nurse said I had to. She said it was important. So every morning, after breakfast, I'd sit on the floor, and she'd bring the baby downstairs and put her in my arms for 15 minutes.
Bibbs mimicked rocking a baby.
Marge? Laura asked.
No, this was your baby nurse. Bibbs' eyes narrowed in concentration. She snapped her fingers.
What was her name?
Something Polish, Douglas responded with a shrug.
Poor thing, never had any children of her own, and she was very possessive of you, Bibbs continued. It was unhealthy. The two of you became so attached, you started screaming every time I held you, so we had to let her go.
Wasn't that the ordeal? She looked at Douglas.
It was an unhealthy bond, he agreed, taking a sip of scotch.
The preemptive fanfare began earlier each year. For weeks it seemed like anything they did and everywhere they went, they were accosted with reminders. Father's Day sale. Happy Father's Day. Looking for a gift for Dad?
Now the actual day was upon them. Laura and Emma arrived at the park to find the group huddled next to a lamppost. It took Laura a moment to register the conflict. Some men of Latino descent were playing soccer in the spot where the t-ball game was supposed to be. Everyone was looking at Tripp, the class father who'd coordinated the event. Tripp stood there chewing the inside of his lip, unsure of how to proceed. Seeing her husband wasn't going to rise to the occasion, Margaret, who had no qualms handling these things, intervened.
If you wouldn't mind taking your game somewhere else, she told the soccer players, we've scheduled a father-daughter t-ball game.
The men looked confused.
Anyone know Spanish? Margaret called back to their group.
When no one stepped forward, she tried again.
Our turn, Margaret barked with authority, pointing to the field. So sorry, but no juego here. Mucho gracias, she bellowed as they packed up their things.
Nicholas was 10, 15, then 20 minutes late.
"I'm sorry," Laura told the group, holding a hand over her eyes as she scanned the premises. "Maybe I should take his place on the team?"
Trip looked down at her feet. She was wearing espadrilles.
"Let's just start without him,"